Sub-Saharan Africa has been fundamental to the global prosperity of the advanced countries. Okay? And Africa had a role to play. It has a role as a raw material producer. We will not allow Sub-Saharan Africa to escape that. Okay, we do everything to keep Sub-Saharan Africa where it is, also impoverished. It's absolutely vital for the prosperity of everyone else. So let's get clear about that. Okay, and this means all the economic structures, all the global institutions, and the economics we teach everyone is all designed to keep Africa exactly where it is. And whether it is Europe or US or now China, it's always the same. We need Africa to be impoverished because we need those raw materials and we need them dirt cheap. Okay, so that's the message. It doesn't mean to say that there's nothing Africans can do. Of course there is. Okay, but this is the opposition that they're fighting. This is what it's about. Because if Africa does do something different, I assure you living standards of all those in Europe and North America and Asia is going to fall. Okay? And that is a big price to pay. I assure you that the West is not going to allow that without a big fight.
Have any truer words ever been spoken? That was the voice of Howard Nicholas, a senior economics lecturer at the International Institute of Social Studies in the Netherlands. This is an excerpt from a lecture he gave on the role of economic policies and international institutes in the, quote, underdevelopment of Africa. A short video from that lecture recently went viral on African social media networks and has led to wide-ranging conversation on how the developed world exploits not only Africa, but the global South in general. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast. My name is Sean Macheza. My guest on the podcast today is Hamza Hamushen. He's done a lot of research on extractivism, energy democracy, food sovereignty, and environmental and climate justice in the North African context. He's also the coordinator for North Africa at the Transnational Institute. We sat down to discuss his latest publication, Extractivism and Resistance in North Africa, which documents several cases of natural resource extraction, which take the form of brutal accumulation by dispossession, degrading environments and ecosystems through the privatization and commodification of land and water. The report also shows that these extractive activities have also been met with new waves of resistance and the entrance of new social actors onto the scene, demanding that wealth generated in resource projects be shared equitably in society. I began by asking Hamza to define what we mean when we talk about extractivism.
Extractivism can be defined as a mode of accumulation and appropriation that has been unleashed by colonialism since 1492, especially with the conquest of the Latin America. And in that respect, it has been shaped through colonialism, shaped by violence and slavery. But to give a proper definition to the term, extractivism refers to activities that overexploit natural resources destined particularly to export to world markets. And as such, it's not limited to only oil, gas, and minerals, but it extends to other productive activities which overexploit land, water, biodiversity, such as agribusiness, intensive forestry, industrial fishing, farming, and mass tourism. So in a way, it is a mode of accumulation and appropriation that has been shaped by a history of colonialism and neocolonialism.
Mm-hmm. I see, as you put it, it's an economy of unpaid costs, right? It's stuff accumulated from a place, but then with a lot of negative externalities that are not necessarily always factored into the final cost of the products.
Actually, a lot of scholars and activists who studied extractivism, especially in the African and Latin American context, as you mentioned, describe extractivism as an activity whose social mm-hmm. and environmental costs are not included in the price of products. But there mm-hmm. are other scholars who go even further and say it's not just extractivism who has which has unpaid social environmental consequences, but the whole capitalist system itself. And mm-hmm. and when you look at the history of capitalism, it has been a history of externalized costs at different levels, from the global north to the global south, through colonialism, slavery, and imperialism, and also externalized costs when it comes to the care work. And here the feminist question and the gender question is very important, and also externalized through racial lines. So that system, actually, when you look at it, the capitalist or the extractivist capitalist system has been generating what Naomi Klein calls sacrifice zones. And mm-hmm. actually this basically reflects what we mean by the externalized environmental and social costs. Because you go at sites of extractions in the global south, either mining, mm-hmm. oil, gas, or agribusiness, and you see really sacrifice zones, environmental degradation, pollution, the prevalence of diseases, as well as poverty, underdevelopment, mm-hmm. poor infrastructure. And actually, that's what I've been seeing during my field work in the North African region, specifically in Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. And mm-hmm. that logic of creating sacrifice zones to maintain the accumulation of capital, to maintain mm-hmm. the concentration of profits in the hands of the few or in the hands of some multinationals, comes at the expense of brown and black bodies whose mm-hmm. livelihood has been sacrificed. That's why we need always to bear in mind the racial character of capitalism and the racial character of extractivism.
And indeed, there's been a sort of an us and them starting from 1492, as you put it. And this puts North Africa, I think, in a particularly interesting relationship with the center of the capitalist system, I guess what would people call the global north, or I would say Europe. And these being right outside the periphery line must have a very unique relationship with the centers of global capitalism. Shall we talk about that? What's the proximity to Europe? What's the impact of that on North Africa?
Yeah. So as I have been saying, that process of, let's say, accumulation by dispossession, or accumulation by underdevelopment, or accumulation by pollution and destruction, we cannot dissociate it from the pivotal role of imperialism and colonialism in the process of capitalist development. So in that aspect, the center periphery configuration of the global capitalist imperialist system must be brought to the discussion, because there is a lot of talk when we talk about the capitalist exploitation to ignore the imperialism as an analytical tool, to ignore the histories of colonialism. And as you said, most parts of the global south have been going through that in varying degrees, and of course with specific contexts. And the North African region has been shaped to be serving the interests of the metropoles or the centers or the cores or of the system, what we call the global north or the Western world, since the colonial period. And the colonial period has been there since the 19th century. It's not like in Latin America since 1492. Since the 19th century, countries like Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco, especially through French colonialism, their economies have been shaped to produce for Europe, to export to Europe, and import industrial products. And this created the relations of unequal change. Since colonial period, that are persisting till today, even after formal independences, what we call the post-colonial period, which is really a period of neocolonialism or the continuation of colonialism in other means. So North Africa, because of its proximity to those centers of empire, to Europe, to the European Union right now, and also because of the richness of its soil. There are a lot of natural resources in the region when it comes to fertile land, when it comes to oil and gas, other minerals, as well as an undervalued labor force. When I say an undervalued, I mean an undervalued labor force by intention, by design. The labor force is cheap there because the system wants it to be cheap there and maintains it to be cheap, to exact more profits, to extract more value, to allow for much more flow of capital from the global south to the global north. So just to come back to North Africa, yes, it plays a geostrategic role in that system, as it is, you could say, the periphery of the European Union. And the European Union does everything to maintain that region in a subordinate position, like inserted in a subordinate position into that global capitalist economy. So on one hand, as I said, a reservoir of cheap labor and an exporter of cheap natural resources, and in the other as an importer of high value industrial projects. So keeping those countries deindustrialized and rendering their economy to be heavily reliant on the export or the production of primary commodities, including agricultural products for export to Europe, is an advantage to the European Union. And this is done through several means.
So there's a deliberate attempt, a deliberate project to keep the economies stuck in the primary phase and to sort of stop the people from aspiring for more, essentially.
Exactly. And these are the politics of the imperialist system, where you have the cores that are in Europe, North America, and Japan, the dependency school called the triad, and you have the peripheries and the semi-peripheries that are being maintained in a dominated and subordinate position, to allow for the accumulation of capital and the concentration of capital in the global north.
So this is going on even after these countries essentially nominally achieved independence from Europe and are self-ruling. This introduces, I think, there's something you touch on in your publication about the fact that colonialism may indeed have ended, but the colonial relationship remains and has sort of reconfigured itself in a particular way, particularly in this region. Would you like to explain some of what you mean there?
Yeah, I think it's I don't want to be simplistic and say that the experiences of those countries, at least when I talk about North Africa or the Maghreb region, have been just an experience of colonialism since colonial times. But maybe I'd like to complicate that statement a bit further. In certain countries, like Algeria, like Egypt, I'm talking specifically in North Africa, and there are other countries in sub-Saharan Africa who tried to do the same experience of delinking. delinking from the imperialist capitalist system, because there was a kind of a rupture, and in some cases a violent rupture, with the colonial system. In the case of Algeria, there has been an armed struggle for liberation against French colonialists. So when the ruling elites, the national bourgeoisie, came to power in Algeria in the 60s, it had that radical vision of, you could say, Algerian socialism, recovering that sovereignty even at the economic level. Of course, that project has been deeply contradictory from the start, because it has been authoritarian, crushing even the organized labor and, you know, communist and lefty parties. But at its heart, it was an attempt to delink from the imperialist capitalist system and to choose an alternative, autonomous, inward-looking development project. So that's Algeria and Egypt. But in other countries, in contrast to that kind of model, in other countries, there was neocolonialism, or the continuation of colonialism directly after that formal independence. And that's the case of Morocco, for example, where the ruling classes, the monarchy in that case, and the landed bourgeoisie and the other elites were pro-West, were pro-France from the start, were liberal, were capitalistic, just continuing the same kind of exploitation as Fanon was you know, describing those parasitic and sterile bourgeoisie, saying...
Throwing parties for the West, essentially, at the expense of their own people.
Yeah, and they are replacing basically the European or the colonial bourgeoisies with an indigenous or local exploitative system. And that's what happened. So there are differences, but what is shared among all these countries and experiences, that even those progressive experiences have been defeated by the late 70s and early 80s by the rise of the neoliberal, what I call the neoliberal counter-revolution, because that neoliberal counter-revolution came to crush those progressive, even contradictory, when I'm not saying they are perfect experiences, but that counter-revolution crushed those experiences, ushering in a new area of, you could say, recolonization or neocolonialism. And there we can see the new tools of that imperial domination, or the neocolonial instruments of the capitalist system, in the form of debts, debts and the servicing of debts. And then the structural adjustment programs dictated by international financial institutions like the IMF and the World Bank.
So these are the tools you were mentioning earlier, the tools that have been used to keep this economy subjugated and to maintain the dominance. That's the debt and the... Would you like to outline all of those?
Yeah, so you have debt, you have the...
Sorry if I disturbed your train of thought.
No, you haven't. But so you have the IFIs, the International Financial Institutions, which are basically the new tools of imperialism. Instead of having direct colonial experiences or direct occupation, you have that way of economic imperialism, those tools, that are being used to enforce an economic development model based on certain ideas coming from the West, based on capitalism, based on exploitation, based on plunder of resources, based on the racialization of bodies. And one of those forms that we can see today clearly is the free trade agreement. They call them free trade, but it's nothing but free, to be honest. It's not free at all. And we've seen how trade has been imposed by force in the past through colonial times. And it continues to be being imposed by force through negotiations, because you have those uneven power relations between the North and South, pushing those countries into one direction. You need to your economic model needs to serve international markets. Your economic model needs to open up for what we call foreign direct investment, needs to open up or give more space for multinationals, for private capital. You need to open your borders, remove environmental and social regulations, discipline labor, make it cheaper. So an elite, a tiny minority, makes profit. When I say a tiny minority, most of that profit, of course, is being siphoned off from the continent towards the north. We know the capital flows, licit and illicit, that come out from the continent, and that includes North Africa as well. But also, you have domestic elites that benefit from that. The parasitic domestic elites that participate in the organized looting of their nations. So they are happy to continue to be the exporters of natural resources to Europe. They are happy to be the agents of multinationals in their own countries. They are happy to facilitate basically the robbery and exploitation of their own people. And this is what scholars call the comprador classes.
The internal colonialism that you mentioned.
Yeah. So this is a form, another form of internal colonialism. And actually the movements and the people that I talked with is in North Africa, and it's sad, to be honest, to hear it, when they say, even if they haven't experienced themselves French colonialism, they say, you know, this is much, much worse than French colonialism.
Good Lord, yeah.
Yeah, so it is tragic to hear like such things, because that's how they feel. They feel colonized in their own countries. That, you know, an even development, it's not even development, it is endemic.
I mean, I will say this is definitely a sentiment that you find across most of the continent. I'm from Zimbabwe myself, and Zimbabweans today feel that the people that took over from the colonial settlers are enriching themselves at an even greater expense to the local people than what the settlers did. They say, well, at least they built bridges, at least they built hospitals and clinics. And I mean, it's very easy to look at how culpable these local elites are, right? But again, I like how you place it, that they're all operating in this international setting, right? Where it's a system where you're given not that many options actually to decouple yourself from the system.
Yeah, it's, you know, this is the project of emancipation is very long, and you know, there are a lot of challenges in the way. That's why the way I see it, Sean, is I don't believe in a liberation in one country. And we've seen it, like in the Arab uprising since 2010, 2011, you cannot have liberation in one country, because those structures of power, that hierarchy in the system, would come down on you and force you to kneel in different means, either economic or military. And we've seen it in Libya, we've seen it in Yemen, we've seen it in Syria. So they force you to kneel in different ways. And that contradictions, just blaming, you know, foreign forces or imperialist forces from the north without having a class analysis of, you know, of the elites of the ruling classes in our own country and how they have been integrated in the transnational world of exploitation. Well, it's a blind spot because any strategy that does not take account, you know, fighting those submissive or parasitic elites or comprador bourgeoisies in our own countries in the global south is doomed to fail. So we need to find a kind of alliances, bring workers, peasants, and employed people, and so on together within that vision, as you were saying. It's not just you're fighting some classes in your own country, but you're fighting a world global disorder. And in that way, alliances, transborders are very important, regionally and internationally.
The third world is not poor. You don't go to poor countries to make money. There are very few poor countries in this world. Most countries are rich. The Philippines are rich. Brazil is rich. Mexico is rich. Chile is rich. Only the people are poor. But there's billions to be made there, to be carved out and to be taken. There's been billions for 400 years. The capitalist European and North American powers have carved out and taken the timber, the flax, the hemp, the cocoa, the rum, the tin, the copper, the iron, the rubber, the bauxite, the slaves, and the cheap labor. They have taken out of these countries. These countries are not underdeveloped, they're overexploited.
Have any truer words ever been spoken? The voice of American political scientist Michael Parenti. And now back to my conversation with Hamza Hamushen, where we discuss his research on extractivism and resistance in North Africa.
So you've got these localized resistances, right, at the grassroots, the rural working poor, the unemployed youth, the people that are affected by the impact of this imperialistic system, right, where you've got transnational companies externalizing costs for Europe and creating these sacrifice zones, and people are fighting at those sacrifice zones. But there are a lot of tensions and struggles within those fights, and they tend to be called environmental movements, right? Can you explain that for me? Because I found that really fascinating to say you've got these different tensions within the struggles, and is it accurate to just call them environmental rights movements?
Yeah, that's a very important question. Actually, I tried to tackle in the report, extractivism and resistance in North Africa, rather than trying to paint a romantic or an idealist picture of those social movements and grassroots forms of resistance. I tried also to look at certain contradictions within those movements and to look at how these movements present themselves, how they articulate their demands in comparison with the international environmental justice movement, or let's say the international environment movement as a whole. So what I found, Sean, is even if there is an environmental element in the demands of these movements and groups, they are not predominantly, environmental movements. And, and basically what matters to them is questions of social justice, the distribution of wealth, employment, local development. So they're not about the conservation of exotic species or pristine nature, like what we see in the middle class European movements, but rather they are in a quest for environmental and social justice, and they are fighting against the social exclusion and the violence and authoritarianism of neoliberalism and its elites. And what I tried to argue in the paper is that these movements can be understood as the latest development in the historical trajectory of class struggle against capitalist exploitation and imperialist domination. At certain junctures, they can be radical and even brandishing anti-imperialist slogans, like in Algeria with the unemployed movements, where they accused the political class of being the agents of imperialism, like this, clearly like this. In southern Tunisia, in Tataouine, where the movement was claiming a nationalization of the oil industry, that is, you know, with a heavy presence of European and US companies. But explicitly, they're not anti-capitalist. Like they ask for jobs in those industries. In a way, they want to be integrated
So they want to share, essentially.
Exactly. They want to share. And sometimes when they get some of the crumbs, even if with precarious and short-term jobs, those movements disintegrate. And that happened in Algeria, happened in Tunisia, happened in Morocco repeatedly. And that begs the question, how can these movements be inscribed in the long term? What are the contradictions inside those movements? And you find that their leadership does not have a radical vision of the struggle. That's why they don't connect with other movements or other issues and struggles at the national level. They don't connect.
It's not seeing it as just one manifestation of this global fight, but rather as just we want a piece of this current pie where we are. Am I getting that right?
Yes. So, but you know, Sean, this is understandable, to be honest, because my experience in the global environmental justice movement or the climate justice movement is people are saying, why are these people asking for jobs in there? Why are they not talking about climate change? We need to stop oil and gas. Why are these people asking for jobs in oil and gas industry?
They need to make a living, right?
Exactly. So that's why we cannot dissociate questions of environmental justice from question of social and economic justice. And we cannot also, you know, disconnect them or dissociate them from questions of national and popular sovereignty. That's why the question of imperialism is very important here. If these people are asking for jobs in the industry because there are no jobs in other sectors, because there is a huge reserve army of labor. Most of those economies are informal economies. In Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria, more than 50% of the labor force work in the informal sector with precarious conditions, and that makes it really hard. So the people need to make a livelihood, and the environmental question is the least of their concerns, even if it is a question of livelihood.
Part of it.
Yeah, sometimes, because it affects their health, it pollutes their environment, it plunders their water. And they are aware of those things, but they have to make a choice. And that's why what I observed, at least in the Maghreb region, in certain movements, that there are contradictions even amongst themselves. Some people saying we need to give the environmental question a much more predominant role in our struggle. Others say, look, when we revolt here, when we protest, we want development, we want jobs. So that's why if we really need to resolve that contradiction, and I think we can manage that contradiction, we need to reflect about what is the alternative economic development model that would offer jobs in clean industries without destroying the environments of those people. And here you start asking the big questions. Because how can Tunisia or Algeria or Morocco be allowed to choose its alternative model development when they are locked into this predatory form of extractivism? That you need to export oil and gas, you need to export phosphate, you need to export to do this. You are locked, and you are locked through different mechanisms, including free trade agreements, including the debt system, including the predominance of multinationals in your own economy. So,
and even when they've tried, right? You mentioned already that in Algeria in the 70s, you had a quite progressive attempt to build something different, but it doesn't work when there's no maneuverable space and you can't do anything different.
So I think...
Are there any attempts? How have these countries, well, perhaps not just North African countries, but how can we resist this free market fundamentalism, this imperative that you have to be open to world markets and sell yourself to them?
I think that's the $1 million question, Sean. If I had the answer, I've already taken over the Algerian state.
We have to start somewhere, man. We have to start somewhere.
No, but you're right. You know what? Just to reflect on what you said, because you know this is a really, really crucial point. That first, I think we need to reflect on the failures of those progressive experiences and attempts to decouple or delink from the imperialist and capitalist system in the 60s and 70s. And there are a lot of lessons that can be learned from those experiences. But we don't, because currently the hegemonic discourse, especially the hegemonic neoliberal discourse, undermines those experiences as just failures. There is nothing to learn from them. They just failed because their principles failed. And because they're like, they didn't have the right approach or the right politics. Yeah. They were wrong. But that's not true. There are a lot of contradictions in those experiences. Mistakes have been made. But as you said, you know, there was not a lot of room to maneuver. But, you know, those experiences in the 60s and 70s, at least they were taking place in a Cold War context that offered them some room to maneuver. It's not a lot. But it offered them some room to maneuver. And don't forget, but the 60s and 70s was the decolonization period. So there was a lot of hope. There was eruption of the masses. And
there was a willingness to try new things, sort of.
Exactly. And that allowed some space for those experiences that have been crushed later on. But we need to learn. There are other experiences in Latin America. You know, they are being defeated right now. And I think more lessons need to be learned there. But the point that I want to make specifically around extractivism. So any economic development model or alternative economic, just alternative economic development model needs to do with extractivism, needs to deal with extractivism. And the neo-extractivism of Latin America is not the answer. What I mean by neo-extractivism is that form of progressive extractivism that broke with neoliberal norms or with market fundamentalism or what we call developmentalism. So
this would be something like what Hugo Chavez tried to do in Venezuela.
Exactly. So like use the proceeds from the oil to fund...
To push a social...
Yeah.
Progressive social agenda.
Progressive social agenda, reduce impoverishment. But, you know, as I said, this has been tried at some point in Algeria in the 60s and 70s and failed. Because that model is basically striking a better deal with capital without changing the foundation of that capitalist exploitation and imperialist domination. You are just striking a better deal.
It still depends on creating, you still have these sacrifice zones, you still have the environmental degradation and the destruction of nature in general, even if now the proceeds are being shared more equally or they are staying more in the country, it doesn't fundamentally change what the problem is. Which is the mode of exploitation.
Yeah, and then Sean, you still are dependent on international markets and the fluctuation of those commodities in the international
as shown by Venezuela. Yeah.
So and that is the problem. So that move towards post-extractivism, you know, has been theorized by so many, you know, scholar activists in Latin America. So it's not as if there is no thought about this, but there is no perfect recipe. You know, one thing that I already mentioned, if you want to move towards post-extractivism, it needs to be a transition. It's a, you know, a long process that needs a lot of efforts, that needs mobilization of the social forces, labor, indigenous communities, women, the poor, they need to embrace that project. But then you need to diversify your own economy. If you want, let's say, I'm talking abstract here. Algeria, 97% of its exports are oil and gas. 97%. I think it's the same number in Venezuela, if I'm not mistaken. So if Algeria wants to move away from oil and gas, let's say, or from the extractivist model, it needs first to industrialize. Algeria with Egypt and South Africa in the 70s were among the most industrialized nation in the continent. Imagine, and Algeria like had just 15 years after colonialism to industrialize it. You see the scope of that project that some nihilists today, some liberal nihilists tell you that experience was just wrong.
It's just a failure.
It's just a failure. No, it was, there are some failures, but it's
the way gains made.
So, and that's why you need to have that long-term vision. Diversify the economy and build trans-border solidarities. Algeria cannot do it on its own. It needs to have that kind of regional integration, let's say in the Maghreb, in North Africa, in, with other parts of the continent. So we can produce together, we can share the wealth together. But this needs you know, a break with those parasitic elites. Needs a radical democratic project. Needs decentralization, needs the involvement of communities. So, and needs a new paradigm of the economy. We need an economy that works, you know, first locally for the local markets rather than produce for the international markets to get some hard currency that, that does not benefit those countries as at all. Just one thing, Sean, that comes to my mind is, just before the Arab uprisings in 2010, when we saw revolutions in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Syria, and so on, and so many dictators have been ousted, the IMF and the World Bank were praising Tunisia and Egypt for spectacular results in their economy of achieving high growth rates. And I think Tunisia, I think, was having 6 or 8% growth rates, and the same for Egypt. But that growth rate does not
mean anything. It wasn't reflecting.
Does not mean anything. It is growth without any development. In the contrary, you see an escalation of the disparities inside those countries. Tunisia, for example, there is a disparity between what we call the Sahel, which is the coast, the bustling touristic town where most of the, some of the industries are based, and then the interior, the underdeveloped interior, the margins, the peripheries, even inside one country. The same thing in Algeria, north and south.
With the north and the south,
And the same thing in Morocco. So we need to learn from these things, and it is a long-term vision. I'm not saying it's going to happen overnight, and it's going to come with contradictions. It's going to come sometimes with compromise, and that depends at the end of the day on the balance of powers on the ground. If you have a balance of power in favor of labor, in favor of unemployed, in favor of the peasantry, or of the working poor in general, those elites or those national bourgeoisies or radical bourgeoisies could you know, move against capital. But without that, you can't. And we've seen it in Chavez. Chavez was not just like a charismatic leader on his own who enacted those progressive policies, but he had a social base.
A movement, there were people backing him up. That's for me what really has a big sort of a contradiction that I always feel when I think about these things is, that neoliberalism has been coupled with democracy. It's almost like these things go together. And how to then have these democratically chosen progressive leaders that can exist outside of this neoliberal setting.
That's the trap.
That's the trap, right? But I mean, seeing as we're almost running out of time, I wanted to ask, like, so in you look at these different movements that are fighting against this exploitation and this dispossession of their land and their resources across these three different countries. From your experience doing this, where's the light at the end of the tunnel? For those that are listening, and just in general, for the movements that are fighting for a more just and socially acceptable world, where's the light at the end of the tunnel?
There is always light, Sean. Even if you look at that, at organized labor and at the configuration of resistance, even if we find a lot of limitations and weaknesses in there, even if those experiences are ephemeral, they do not achieve what is needed, resistance always springs up. People are not just passive victims in the face of capitalist exploitation or in the face of those destructive industries. People rise, resist, formulate their demands in different ways, are creative in their forms of resistance. A lot of people, let me give you just an example, gave a death sentence on the Arab uprisings, said, the Arab Spring turned into an Arab winter and all those experiences failed. They recognize that maybe Tunisia is an exception. But then 10 years later, we've seen an eruption of popular movements again in the scene, in the region, from Sudan, Algeria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Iran. And they have been joined in 2019 with other movements all over the world. Chile, Belarus in 2020, Hong Kong. There are a lot of protests that are basically a reflection of the discontent against that neoliberal globalization that dispossesses people, that impoverishes them, that makes their livelihoods precarious. So in that sense, I am optimistic, but there is always a but. We need to reflect on how to do better next time.
And I believe, learn the lessons.
Yeah, to learn the lessons. And I believe that, every context have its own specificities. And in the case of North Africa, labor has been fragmented. The peasantry has been fragmented and disorganized. So we need to learn to organize ourselves and build alliances between every sections of those resistance movements, between the unemployed and labor, between labor and the peasantry, between that and the environmental movement, anti-war movement, anti-patriarchy, anti-racial movements. So we need to connect the dots between, it's easier said than done, but that's the only way, because the problem is systemic and the response to it needs to be systemic. So those eruptions will continue to come back, will continue to happen as long as that same system is still in place. And, with the pandemic right now, that system is just showing that it
is inadequate.
Yeah, inadequate at so many levels, not just socioeconomic, but environmental and even biological. So it is in a crisis. Can we, as progressive forces all over the world, can we build an alternative to it? Can we push at least for some kind of opening that allow us to maneuver a little bit? Can we help struggles in the global south? I think one major point that I'd like to make, that any analysis of capitalism that does not take account the colonial legacies or imperialism as a tool of analysis won't, I think, go far, won't be in true active solidarities with struggles in the global south.
Thanks for joining us on the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. My name is Sean Macheza. Many thanks to my colleague Hamza Hamushen, with whom I had this conversation, based on a report he authored recently called Extractivism and Resistance in North Africa. The full report is available on our website. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, www.tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you, and see you next time.